Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Good morning.
So, many of you will remember our fall practice period last year, receding into the distance a bit, but still memorable, I think, for those who got their feet wet or plunged in to the practice, to practicing with Zen koans. We practiced with the koans from the collection called the Gateless Barrier, or the Mumonkan, and Todd here was our shuso, or head monk, and between Todd and Michael and me, we did quite a few talks about these koans, but we really only covered less than half of the 48 in the collection. And so there were a few others that made my short list that I didn't get to, that didn't make my final selection, and I'd like to talk about one of them today. Now, there may be a few people here who are not familiar with... is anyone who hasn't heard that word? Koan? Yeah. So maybe you have heard of strange Zen questions like, what is the sound of one hand clapping? Or what was your face before your parents were born? Have you ever heard any of those strange questions? Yeah, those are... Zen koans are... they're mostly dialogues. They're mostly in the form of dialogues. They're old stories. From ancient China, most of them come from, 8th, 9th century China. And they were passed down as stories, and then they were collected in written form in various collections and came to be used as teaching stories, but also as sometimes a question to hold as an object of meditation, much more so in the Rinzai school of Zen than in our Soto school of Zen. But we use them to as well in our practice, and these questions can serve to kind of shift us out of our conventional dualistic ways of thinking, our habits of thinking. Some of them are strange and seemingly impenetrable, hard to understand, and that's deliberate, because we can't understand them. They're deliberate on the part of these old Chinese Zen masters to nudge us, to push us out of our conventional ways of thinking. So we can't understand them that way. So this one that I'm going to share with you today, I think is not so hard, actually. I think we can all relate to this one. So there are two characters in this short dialogue. A monk named Qing Shui and a Zen master named Cao Shan. So the monk came to Cao Shan, presumably his teacher, and he said, "I am Qing Shui, solitary and destitute. Please give me alms." So alms, the monks would traditionally go around with begging bowls and ask for donations of food or money, and that's what alms means. "Please give me alms." And Cao Shan said, "Venerable Shui," addressing the monk. Qing Shui said, "Yes, sir." Cao Shan said, "You have already drunk 3 cups of the finest wine in China, and still you say you have not moistened your lips." So solitary and destitute. Solitude, destitution. These are two of the things that we find most frightening. Right? As human beings, we're social animals. to be isolated, you know, to be alone, lonely. And to be destitute without the material means to sustain our lives. To be alone and destitute is particularly daunting with the prospect of old age. You know, you don't really think about it when you're in your 20s, or maybe your 30s, but as you get older, it becomes a very real fear, I think, particularly for women. Who, even in our very affluent society, have significant lower incomes on the average than men. And even if a woman has a male partner, she's statistically likely to outlive him and to face significantly decreased income and maybe poor health. So it can be a little scary. And any of you who have older parents, I know my own parents are still alive at 92 and 94. And all their old friends, just about all their old friends, their siblings are all gone, right? How does that feel? So we could easily take this koan at face value and look deeply into our fear of losing, you know, those we love, or livelihood. This is a good place to start, and we'll come back to it. But Qing Shui was posing a deeper and a more existential question, I think. And a clue to this comes from the relationship between these two characters. Cao Shan, the Zen master, was the disciple of Dongshan Liangjie in 9th century China, and the two of them, master and disciple, are said to have been the founders of our stream of Zen, Caodong, which became Soto in Japanese. And there are competing theories about the origin of this name, but the most accepted theory is that one syllable came from each of the two co-founders' names, Cao Dong. Except that the Cao, which is the disciple's name, comes first, so that's a little puzzling. But maybe it sounded better. Nothing is known about this other character, Qing Shui, the disciple in this story. But in one commentary I read, it suggests that the fact that he is even named instead of just being an anonymous monk, because many of the monks asking questions of the Zen masters aren't even named in these old stories, but he is named, that suggests that he was a person of some standing and an experienced practitioner. Also, Cao Shan addresses him as venerable. He calls him Venerable Shui. Wu Men, who compiled this collection of koans, says in his comment, see, this is what happens, these koans are commented upon, and then someone else comments, and someone else comments, and here we are commenting again over the centuries. But Wu Men commented, Qing Shui is submissive in manner, but what is his real intention? Cao Shan has the eye and thoroughly discerns what Qing Shui means. And then he asks us, tell me, where and how has Qing Shui drunk wine? What does that mean? You've already drunk 3 cups of the best wine in China. When Qing Shui comes to his teacher and says, I am solitary and destitute, we can imagine he's actually being forthright about his inner state. Maybe he's saying, I've been doing this practice for years. I thought I had some deep insights. At times I thought I understood the Dharma. But right at this moment, I just feel so alone. I don't know what's the point of my life anymore. I'm destitute of meaning. He's asking his teacher, maybe even challenging his teacher, not for alms, but what can you say to me? What can you say to me in this state I'm in? Or maybe these two are old friends. Maybe they're peers, and Ching Shui is having a bad moment, and he just wants to see what Cao Shan is going to say to him. You know, you do this with a friend, right? If you've ever had a friend or loved one who is suffering from depression, you know yourself how you can't just talk them out of it, right? So Cao Shan isn't going to just try and talk Ching Shui out of it. But when it's a spiritual state that's been called the dark night of the soul, St. John of the Cross wrote a little book called The Dark Night of the Soul. Descending into the depths of great doubt, then sometimes a key word, a key question can turn it, can open up that state. And that's the kind of alms that Ching Shui is requesting, I think, here. There's a kind of spiritual malaise, a word that fell out of use and has and came back into use in our language, but it's unusual. In the Greek, it comes from the Greek acidia, or axidiae. Acidia, and it's kind of, there's no one English word that fits from what I've read. It's kind of like apathy, or kind of listlessness, but it can also be have a restlessness. You know how depression can be kind of restless and apathetic at the same time? A parched or dull quality. In these states, we feel like, what's the point of it all? Why am I doing this? Why am I sitting with throbbing knees and monkey mind or deep, wrenching sadness? You know, my zazen. I want to read a beautiful passage from the journals of Thomas Merton, the great Benedictine contemplative poet and activist, who was also well-versed in Zen practice. He was very interested in Zen practice. And this comes from 1965, his journal of 1965, when he was practicing in a hermitage in the woods outside Gethsemane, which was a Benedictine monastery. He says, this is Thomas Merton, "The solitary life, now that I really confront it, is awesome, wonderful, and I see I have no strength of my own for it. Deep sense of my own poverty, and above all, awareness of the wrongs I have allowed in myself, together with this good desire. This is all good. I am glad to be shocked by grace and to wake up in time to see the great seriousness of it. I have merely been playing at this, and the solitary life does not admit of mere play. Contrary to all that is said about it, I do not see how the really solitary life can tolerate illusion and self-deception. It seems to me that solitude rips off all the masks and all the disguises. It does not tolerate lies. Everything but straight and direct affirmation is marked and judged by the silence of the forest." So you notice he used that word, he said he had a deep sense of his own poverty. He's not referring to his financial situation. And I don't think Ching Shui in our story was either. This poverty is a radical non-attachment, not only to things, but to relationships, concepts, doctrines. And later in this passage, he also uses that word, acedia. As I said, it comes from the Greek meaning not caring. Not caring. So it's kind of like apathy or ennui. And it can involve an inability to function in daily activities. It's similar to depression, but not identical. Kathleen Norris is a poet and essayist who has spent much time in Benedictine monastic environments doing contemplative practice. Although she's married, had children, and teaches and writes. And she's written a whole book about her relationship to this experience of acedia. She calls it A Marriage, Monks, and a Writer's Life, Acedia and Me. She says, I would suggest that while depression is an illness treatable by counseling and medication, acedia is a vice that is best countered by spiritual practice and prayer. So if we were going to convert that sentence, that last sentence, into Buddhist language, we would not call it a vice. We would call it a hindrance. The hindrances, and we would substitute meditation for prayer. So we'd say, acedia is a hindrance that is best countered by spiritual practice and meditation. And when we say spiritual practice, that means not just meditation, of course, in the Buddhist context, but the entire Eightfold Path, you know, the practice of right speech, right mindfulness, right conduct, right view, etc. The whole package is spiritual practice, not just meditation. But the hindrances, traditionally the hindrances are states that cloud the mind. Right, that obscure clear awareness of the present moment. So the traditional hindrances are desire. You can't see the present moment if you're wanting something that's not present. Aversion. You can't be in the present moment if you're clouded by, I don't like this, I want to get out of this. Agitation and restlessness is another. And another one sometimes is called sloth and torpor. Aren't they funny words, sloth and torpor? But that doesn't mean tiredness and sleepiness. Have you ever noticed when you're doing Zen practice, sometimes you actually feel you're just sleepy because you didn't get enough sleep. But sometimes you're just drifting, and it's not sleepiness. It's a kind of spacing out, drifting, torpor, yeah. Or it's a different kind of weariness, yeah. That's what this one is. And that, I think, corresponds more to this word that I'm using, acedia. It's a subtle form of aversion and avoidance. It's just, And then the fifth hindrance is, of course, doubt. And that's a big one. How many of you have ever suffered from doubt? Right? I have. We can certainly fall prey to doubt in our states, particularly of isolation and destitution. Right? Doubt comes in strongly sometimes. So it's important to recognize the difference between what's called small doubt and great doubt. So small doubts are, oh, those little niggling doubts. I could have done it this way, I should have done that, I should have decided this. Oh, I should, maybe this is not the right job. This is not the right relationship. This is not the right spiritual practice or teacher. You know, always, those are small doubts. Should have got the other vacuum cleaner, right? Great doubt is the way we hold with an open mind and heart just how much we don't know. You know, the big questions in life. What is life and death? What is Buddha? These come up in the koans. What is Buddha? What is Buddha comes up in a koan, they never say, oh, you know, it's a guy who was born in India, you know, and give the historical story. They always give something quite illogical. What is Buddha? Or why did Bodhidharma come from the West? Why did Bodhidharma bring Zen practice from India to China? And they never want the historical story. They'll say something like the oak tree in the courtyard. Something quite non-rational. What was your face before your parents were born? These unanswerable koans push us to the edge of great doubt. So in this book by Kathleen Norris, she begins with a passage from a 4th century Christian monk, Evagrius Ponticus. I'm going to read it to you because it sounds remarkably contemporary. So as I read this, just think about your own life and practice and see how much of this resonates or has at some point. The demon of asceticism, also called the noonday demon, sometimes depression is called, there's a substantial book about depression called The Noonday Demon. The demon of asceticism is the one that causes the most serious trouble of all. He presses his attack upon the monk about the fourth hour and besieges the soul until the eighth hour. First of all, he makes it seem that the sun barely moves at all and that the day is 50 hours long. Then he constrains the monk to look constantly out the windows, to walk outside his room, to gaze carefully at the sun to determine how far it stands from the ninth hour or lunchtime, to look this way and that, to see if perhaps one of the other monks is appearing. It's like waiting for that bell to ring at the end of the period. Yeah. Then, too, he instills in the heart of the monk a hatred for the place, a hatred for his very life itself, a hatred for manual labor. He leads him to reflect that clarity has departed from among his brothers, that there is no one to give encouragement. Should there be someone at this period who happens to offend him in some way or other, this too the demon uses to contribute further to his hatred. This demon drives him along to desire other sites where he can more easily procure life's necessities, more readily find work and make a real success of himself. He goes on to suggest that, after all, it is not the place that is the basis of pleasing the Lord. God is to be adored everywhere. He joins to these reflections the memory of his dear ones and of his former way of life. He depicts his life stretching out for a long period of time and brings before the mind's eye the toil of the ascetic struggle and, as the saying has it, leaves no leaf unturned to induce the monk to forsake his monastery and drop out of the fight. No other demon follows close upon the heels of this one when he is defeated, but only a state of deep peace and inexpressible joy arise out of his struggle. So that was from the 4th century, but could have been today, in terms of that. Of that feeling of just being mired in dissatisfaction. Yeah. Norris, in her book, comments, asceticism is the monk's temptation because in a demanding life of prayer, or you could say meditation, it offers the ease of indifference. Yet I have come to believe that asceticism can strike anyone whose work requires self-motivation and solitude. Anyone who remains married, for better or worse. Anyone who is determined to stay true to a commitment that is sorely tested in everyday life. So that could be an artistic discipline, a writer, or a marriage, or anything that requires staying power. So that's why I think this koan is our koan too, even though we're not full-time monks. We still need staying power. Norris says, we might well ask if these crazy monks don't have it coming. If your goal is to pray without ceasing, aren't you asking for trouble? Is this a reasonable goal or even a good one? Pray without ceasing, the injunction she's referring to comes from the words of the Apostle Paul to the Thessalonians in the Bible. Rejoice always, pray without ceasing, in everything give thanks. Rejoice always, pray without ceasing, in everything give thanks. This is a practice taken up by the contemplative Christian orders, like the Benedictines, as a way of cultivating a quiet, attentive mind. It's very similar to our own practice. But this pray always, pray without ceasing, also has been interpreted in rather fundamentalist ways. Once I was doing a training of hospice volunteers. And that year, some spiritual care volunteers were asked to take the hospice training. They were required to take the hospice training. And as I had done before, I did a kind of simple mindfulness meditation with the volunteers. I didn't even call it meditation. I called it a sort of self-awareness check-in or something like that. I thought I had made it sufficiently secular. But afterwards, the spiritual care volunteers came up to me and asked if they could be excused next time, because they believed that to have a quiet mind would let the devil in. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So to pray constantly meant you had to always have the words of a prayer constantly in mind, yeah, like a mantra. But the Catholic theologian and writer Henri Nouwen gives a much more benevolent interpretation to this phrase, pray always. He says the literal translation of the Greek is come to rest, come to stillness. However, he says the rest the monk seeks is not easy. He says it has little to do with the absence of conflict or pain. It is rest in God in the midst of a very intense daily struggle. So if we were to put this in terms of Zen practice, we'd say we're not trying to escape the world or block it out, but to practice resting in the boundlessness of the present moment. Just this breath, just this step, just the sound of the hummingbird buzzing at the feeder as I was writing this, in the midst of the pouring rain. I hear this little buzz. The great Japanese Zen hermit poets made it their practice to bring their moments of solitude and destitution right into their the present awareness and express them in poems. Express that in poems. So Basho, the great haiku poet, wrote, "This wandering life, cuckoo calling deep in the forest, deepens my loneliness." And Ryokan, in the early 19th century, Basho, that was the 17th century, Ryokan in the 19th, wrote, "Clear skies ring with the honk of wild geese. On deserted hills, leaves whirl in the wind. Twilight on a smoky village road, carrying an empty begging bowl and walking home alone." And in the book, that one is followed by a similar poem where he actually says, "Poor and alone, that's my life." And I wished I could see the original to see the characters and see if he may even be making direct reference to this koan. I suspect he knew this koan. And then another early 20th century poet, and they're all in our Zen tradition. Santoka, I neglected to bring the book of his, but he has this sequence of poems, of short haiku about weeds. And I'm going to just try and paraphrase them for you. One goes something, very simply, it's like, it's a good day, withered grasses. And another, the one right after it says, it's a bad day, scattered weeds. And another one says, in happiness, in sadness, weeds flourish. And then another, along the path, tiny flowers amongst the weeds. They're very short little poems. And they made me think of, well, for one thing, that in Zen language, grasses or weeds refer to the phenomena of our daily life. All the little, everything about our daily life, the world of birth and death and pleasure and pain are weeds, grasses, myriad things. In Zen language and poetry. And you may remember Dogen's words, in attachment blossoms fall, and in aversion weeds spread. What we love and want to hang on to will inevitably change and go away, and what we dislike will keep arising just like weeds. Right? So in this practice of ours, of observing self and world just as it is. You know, there's that word thusness, meaning just this, just the way it is in this moment. In that practice, those old poets found sometimes connection in the humblest of places and things, and open to a kind of wisdom and compassion for themselves and the world. So if we go back to our koan, Wu Men asks us, where and how has Ching Shui drunk wine? What is the wine Ching Shui has already drunk? What do you think? What is the wine that he has already drunk? You could say it was the wine of the Dharma. But if you thought the Dharma is all the sutras he'd studied and Dharma talks he'd listened to, you'd be mistaken. Maybe it's nothing quite that lofty. Maybe the wine that he's already drunk is the quavering song of a thrush in the forest, or the cry of a loon on a northern lake, or the blue of a wild chicory flower. Or maybe it's a stranger's smile or a child's laughter. Or maybe it's the wine in your own empty begging bowl. Sometimes when your life and practice seem parched and flavorless, it's the present moment. It's the vividness of what's right in front of you that wakes you up. That dull, monotonous self-focus drops away and you're alive again. And that may or may not be pleasant or unpleasant. You may be sad, but you're vividly sad. And you may be delighted, like a delighted child. Whatever it is, it will change. Right? And you'll change. There are times in our lives when we feel stripped to the bone. When someone we love dies, or a relationship ends, or a job we've given decades of our lives to, or sometimes when we're far away from a beloved home, we do feel alone and destitute. We feel so alone. These are the times to have great patience and kindness towards our own stumbling steps. And these are the times when we must gradually allow the world to touch us again and invite us back to life. Just a few days ago, I read a short bit about a man who survived the great Kanto earthquake and tsunami and nuclear disaster in Japan in 2011. He lost his father, his wife, and his youngest daughter, who was 7. His father's and wife's bodies were found within a few weeks, but because of high levels of radioactivity, the search was called off before his daughter's remains could be found. And he continued to search for almost 6 years with help from others until he finally found a single bone that was positively identified as his child's. And after that, something in him released, and he relocated and started a hostel for travelers, which also has become a kind of center for environmental activists working against nuclear power and for energy sustainability in Japan. And in this little interview, it was a beautifully done I don't want to call it a comic strip because it wasn't comical, but it was beautiful. It had a beautiful lightness to it by a young Japanese man who is doing a kind of visual strip. What do you call them?
Graphic.
Thank you! Having a moment. Not a novel, but graphic reportage. I've got it. Graphic reportage on disasters in Japan. Beautifully done. And in his interview with this man, the man said, in the little balloon strip, he said, "How much of the Earth's precious resources do we really need to live well? Does it take losing everything to make us realize what really matters? There must be a way to live simply and to the full without all these unnecessary conveniences." So sometimes it's amazing what comes to fill our empty bowls when we think there's nothing left to live for. We can learn from the quiet courage of ordinary people like that man who survived extraordinary loss. We can learn from the moon, the tides, the seasons, our bodies. And we can learn from the old Zen ancestors who did the same. So that's our koan for the day. And thank you all for listening. May our intentions